Hi, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started because I have a feeling today is going to be a really fruitful and active conversation. So this is the Care and Community as a Climate Solution panel. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists briefly. Can you hear me okay?
No.
Okay. All right. I have to speak right into it. Now can you hear me okay? Okay. So this is the Care and Community as a Climate Solution panel. I'm going to briefly introduce our panelists, give a very brief introduction for the panel, and then kick us off with questions, and we should have plenty of time at the end for questions from the audience. So our esteemed panelists today are Yesenia Funes. Yesenia is a journalist that's covered climate and environment through an intersectional lens for a decade. She's been published in The Guardian, Vox, Vogue, Cosmopolitan, and more. She is now leading the CARES Media Initiative, which is dedicated to connecting audiences, reporters, emotions, and sources to boost mental health among environmental and climate journalists. Gigi Mohammed is the Senior Manager of Digital Safety and Free Expression at Pen America.
Just to add something that, like, Gigi, what you said obviously is brilliant. That's the work you do. Something else that comes to mind for me is just all of the ways that indirectly underrepresented communities are under attack. And so carrying the weight of legislation that's working to silence Black and brown communities or queer voices or trans voices, like, those are other weights that are carried, even if it doesn't manifest necessarily in the comment section directly for people. And so I just also want to acknowledge that piece of it, which is that there is so much weight that we carry, just to validate those who maybe aren't getting the hate comments, to recognize that there's still a lot of hate that we're recipients of, even if it's less direct, right?
So something that I have learned a lot from being part of the Uproot Project is just how inspiring communities of color who are on the front lines of the environmental crisis are, and how, like, I've just learned so much about what community care really looks like from reading the work of Uprooters reporting on these issues. And so, Yesenia, can you talk a bit about how journalists can bring hope and resilience that they're seeing in these communities into their own experience as environmental journalists?
Yeah, I really want to shout out the work of the Solutions Journalism Network, which is doing really critical sort of storytelling shaping to provide tools and advice and guidance and resources to journalists so that we can do a better job of telling those stories. I would challenge you all to ask yourselves to find the people who give you hope, right? Like, we are individuals as well with our own opinions and feelings. And I know that traditionally journalists are told to not let their feelings guide their storytelling. But I do think that when we allow our own emotions to guide us, we can find those stories that will resonate with other people as well. Because if it's resonating with us, there has to be someone else out there who's also going to feel the same feelings that you're feeling as they read your piece. So maybe that's a scientist, right? Maybe you're really into conservation, and maybe there's a scientist doing some monumental work on pandemic prevention. I'm doing this profile on Raina Plowright, who's a pandemic prevention specialist, and it's been really, really dope to dig into stories that are not just about community plight and find folks who are actively working on the solutions, right? And that could be in a scientific setting, that could be in a community setting, that could be in a policy setting. I love profiles, and so I think that's a really easy sort of way to do more hope messaging in our stories. And I also think we need to ask our sources, like, what is powering you? Where do you find hope? What are the stories of resilience that you want to see us uplift? You know, I'm often asking my sources, like, how do you want to see yourself reflected in this piece? What story do you want to read about your community? And to ensure that, you know, what I'm writing aligns with the realities that they're experiencing. It's tough work, but I do think that people are oftentimes a vessel to tell those stories. And I'm a Solutions Journalism Network fellow this year, and so I'm sure I'll be learning more about how to do that well. But curious if other folks have thoughts, because it's still something that I'm working on myself.
I think I want to add something, not necessarily related to sources, but one of the things is that we also need to understand our own triggers generally when we're doing this work. And I think about, like, we think about safety general from, like, a before, during, and after. So before I'm going on an assignment, I do, for example, my risk assessment. I know a lot of people hate the word risk assessment, but I promise there are ways to make it very simple. But I do my risk assessment, and then when I think about these things, I don't only think about where I'm going, if there is a potential of a natural disaster, or if there is a potential of any specific physical harm or risk. I think about my digital vulnerabilities, of course, but I also think about my psychological part of it. Do I, like, for example, I used to cover human rights abuses in Egypt, and I have a bad relationship with the police. So when I moved here, I understood that this is a trigger for me, and I understood that if I go to a place early on, like 7-8 years ago, when I see the police, it doesn't translate in my mind that this is a different type of police, although I have the same problem here. But there was a little bit harder. So it's like my brain doesn't understand that this is a different country, a different environment. Yes, you have a problem with it, but not really that much of a problem with it. Like, it depends on where you are, and I'm still new to the country. But our brains and our minds make meaning with traumatic events and how we process it. And it's important for us to understand that, because we can see everything in a specific lens that might not be exactly what's happening. And that includes finding the resiliency, finding the joy, finding all of the nice things that we can. I mean, climate and nice, I know these two don't go hand in hand a lot, but we can find stories. We can find this information, but we also need to understand our own psychological well-being or all of the triggers that we have so we can work through them. Because that also affects how we talk to sources, how we perceive information we're receiving as well.
You guys are all nodding. Go ahead and jump in.
I'll just say, I think a lot of where my nodding is coming from is just, as you share that, Gigi, just realizing climate is an emotional issue. Like, dealing, we all recognize this. Dealing with something that is, you know, this crisis, I mean, like, of course that's an emotional issue. And so, like, one, the subjects of our stories or the folks that we feature, like, through Drawdowns, bless you, the folks that we feature through Drawdowns Neighborhood who are working in climate, like, it's, for me, it just feels like an incomplete story to not ask them about the emotional aspects, ask them about their motivations, ask them not only about the problems, but about their superpowers, about where they get rest, about, like, what they're doing in their free time. I love when I'm sitting with someone, just to, as an excuse to go back to something you said, Yasin, like, the way that people are talking about, like, oh, I love reality TV or podcasts. I'm like, yes, find hobbies and ways of just finding joy and filling your life up that aren't obsessing over the crisis that we have. For me, it's so easy because I look and I just see, like, we're covering people. Let's create space for those people to fully show up. But I think that also applies for, like, me as a storyteller who interviews folks. That applies to journalists. That applies to anyone who's making space for others and their emotions. Like, that makes it even more critical for us to recognize our emotions, to have conversations, authentic conversations where we are, like, talking about how we're doing rather than just pretending that we're robots and moving ahead, because we're not. Like, there are limits to what we can handle. And I'm actually surprised that, like, I mean, I guess this is the world that we're in, so I'm not surprised, but, like, therapy should be, like, a benefit for organizations or for people who are covering and digesting the stories of others, especially with how much trauma is involved in those stories. We're not there yet, but we should be there. We can get there. Like, I truly believe it.
Yeah, I want to jump in there. And I don't know how many of y'all have friends in, like, other industries, but one of my close friends works in fashion, and their company just has, like, an in-house therapist that they can go to whenever they have a personal stress or a work stress. And I'm just like, imagine how nice it would be if newsrooms had therapists in-house that after like an awful reporting trip or a very intense reporting trip, awful is not a fair word, you can go and check in with the therapist, debrief, build a relationship with a therapist. Just make it immediately accessible. It's not that radical. It exists in other industries, and I don't know why newsrooms aren't investing in that. Seems like a simple solution to a lot of our problems.
Just to kind of jump off this too, because I am a big proponent of therapy. Mm-hmm. When I think of ways that I provide myself with self-care, going to therapy for me is a form of self-care. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you can't or don't have access to a therapist, finding ways where you can, you know, healthily channel your emotions, whether that be journaling or working out or however you can expend that energy that you have inside of you when you're feeling these like eco anxieties and climate anxieties or just general anxiety. I feel anxiety about everything.
Same.
I think that that is something that I have found really, really powerful, and also something that one of my friends told me that I try to carry with me, that rest isn't unproductive. You are being productive when you are resting because you are filling your own cup. And that's something that I try to think about and try to think about, okay, I can only do this work if my cup is full. Because if I don't have a full cup, I can't give to anybody else.
I want to add one last thing to that as well, is that I know that the concept of self-care has been commercialized and like capitalism, like sell you this and this and this. But find the thing that works for you. And it's really therapy, again, very like you. I really recommend therapy for everyone if it's possible. But find the thing that works for you. And that can be extremely simple, like blocking an hour of your calendar to just breathe, sit there, do something, take deep breaths, deep breathing. Does not work for me, stresses me out, but it might work for you. So you really need to find like the thing that works for you. It's not, there is no right or wrong answer as long as it's not harmful. So if going for a walk, one of my favorite activities is actually laying on the floor, the ground, and staring at my ceiling. I feel like I need to feel the gravity somehow, and I need not to be looking at anything that has content. So my ceiling is empty. It's boring. And that works. Like, it helps my nervous system. A weighted blanket works, actually, because, like, it suppresses your nervous system and helps you calm down or, like, take it slower. So it's you just need to find what works for you. And really, there is not a wrong or right answer there. Find whatever it is that works for you.
Yeah. Thank you all for those answers. One of the through lines, I think, through this whole conversation for me that is going to be the thing I keep thinking about after this panel is that it's so important to recognize ourselves and all environmental journalists, but like everyone, as whole people. We're so, I think, especially in modern capitalist society, we're kind of fractured a lot of the time, especially in our roles as professionals. And everyone here has talked about, you know, seeing our sources as whole people, understanding ourselves as whole people, and as humans who have all this trauma and emotion and everything, but also all of the other things. And it is radical. It shouldn't be radical, but it is radical to really ask, how do I bring my whole self with me everywhere? So before we move on to audience questions, I just want to give all of our panelists an opportunity to share some of their favorite initiatives, efforts, and resources that you know about to help environmental journalists being their whole selves.
I'll jump in. I've been working closely with Rebecca Weston of the Climate Psychology Alliance of North America to develop the CARES Media Initiative, connecting audiences, reporters, sources, audiences, reporters, emotions, and sources to build mental health resources for environmental journalists. And so if anybody wants to talk about that, we have like a little Google form that we've set up so we can start building like a list of folks. We're working with the Dart Center to develop a survey that we want to send out, like an academic evidence-based survey to just assess the needs of journalists and figure out how we can start building out what those resources could look like, whether that's like free therapy funds or newsroom trainings or a resource guide. It's still very preliminary, early stages. This is going to be probably like a several years process as these things tend to go, but would love to share more with folks and connect if anyone wants to dig into that some more.
I mean, this is shamelessly self-promotional, but I have to talk about the Uproot Project. We are an organization for and by environmental journalists of color, and one of the things that I mentioned before is we hold space for environmental journalists of color to talk about what they're going through, how they're dealing with it, and I think it's a really great resource if you are even looking for a mentor or just a colleague that might have had the same experience as you and need that experience validated. But we also offer trainings, events, fellowships, and resources as well. We have a really great resource on our website about how to start a DEI conversation in your newsroom if your newsroom does not have a DEI initiative. So if you are interested in learning more about that, you can talk to us or visit our website.
And we also have associate members for non-environmental journalists of color. So if you want to learn more about how to support members of the Uproot Project, you should also get in touch with us.
Yeah, I'll also just add in, because there are, you know, I always go to like the simplest, like most low tech, but like finding community, like, and there are so many great organizations. I think of SJN was mentioned, Solutions Journalism Network, Uproot Project. Of course, I was going to mention the Uproot Project as a great community and resource. But no, I mean, I would also just say in the realm of shameless self-promotion of things that, you know, one of the things I love as like the host of and creator of the series Drawdowns Neighborhood, I mentioned this climate solution short documentary series focused on underrepresented voices and communities, is that the response that I hear from people all the time is like, wow, I never thought that climate conversations or a climate short documentary series would welcome people to like show up so fully and talk about or show up in the ways that they do. And one of the things that's so helpful and refreshing to me, even other than just like actually knowing all the people, is the conversations about identity and how we show up. So I think specifically of like one of, well, I think of so many interviewees, but I think of one of our series that we just filmed in the San Francisco Bay Area, featuring seven people. And, you know, like something I actually always forget is that, you know, as someone who's part of the series and the host and the interviewer, like there is always representation of like a young Black queer person on every single episode, which I'm so proud of. And I think I take for granted, but with the series in the Bay Area, we had predominantly people of color, like mostly queer people. And just the fact that we're having conversations about that and how those identities like tie into how we show up, why we show up, and our superpowers in doing this work. Like, to me, just those reminders that we don't need to compartmentalize and filter are really helpful, because so often climate conversations are just the statistics, the data, the science, this narrow focus, rather than being really inclusive of who we are and being intersectional. Like, all we deserve to show up fully as humans, as we've been saying here today. And even just rewatching those episodes, which I was doing this morning, like I'm reminded that I deserve to take up that space. And I think we all need those reminders that each of us and our story subjects deserve to take up space.
Thank you so much. To continue the shameless self-promotion, at Pan America Digital Safety Team, we provide a lot of trainings for journalists to know how to protect themselves from doxing, hacking, how to navigate online abuse, but also we provide trainings for newsrooms, and we work with them on how to set up best practices and policies within the newsroom itself, so that like their safety response is not ad hoc approach, but actually like takes into account that many, many different identities of people, and that this needs to be something that is ongoing, not just as a response to something that happens. And at Aegis Safety Alliance, we provide a lot of safety trainings, whether that's physical, digital, or psychological safety, and psychological first aid trainings as well. And also, I would really recommend you check out the last report we published about the power of peer support, which talks about how can we as an industry build small group peer support networks that can be inclusive and diverse and also sustainable in a way that provides people with the space, similarly to that, of the space that they can share and support each other. Because therapy, again, but not for everyone, maybe, and also peer support is a really wonderful tool for people to be supported in a way. But there is also JTSN, the Journalist Trauma Support Network, I think that's the acronym for, and they provide a lot of really good trainings, and they mainly focus on psychological well-being and trauma for journalists. And the DART Center and International Women's Media Foundation, they provide a lot of trainings for journalists, not necessarily only environmental journalists, but like any journalist. And they're doing now, for the elections, they're doing a safety tour, actually. And they go to a lot of swing states, and they do physical safety and digital and psychological safety trainings. So check all of these out. There's a lot of resources. And please come talk to me if you want more details.
Thank you all so much for that wonderful discussion. We're going to move on to audience questions now. I just want to remind everybody that SEJ is created by and for our journalists. So SEJ members and other journalists are encouraged to ask questions. And please, when you're going to ask a question, I'll hand you the mic and identify yourself, say your name and your affiliation before you get started with your question. I'm just going to stand up and come over there. And
thank you, Sophia.
Thank you, guys. That was amazing.
Hi, my name is Jen Byers. I'm an investigative journalist, and I work with Gigi at Aegis, which we co-own. One of the things that I would like to ask you guys for advice about is, like, I'm pretty open about mental health, and I really want to destigmatize it. I commonly say things like PTSD is a job hazard, you know what I mean? But I meet a lot of opposition from, like, the old guard, a lot of older white dudes who've never had the therapy they've needed, that like make sincerely compromising, you know, professional judgments about me. So do y'all have any advice for handling the kind of tension between like wanting to be open about it and wanting to like create space for people, while kind of also like not catching the heat that can come with that judgment?
Unionize your newsrooms, I think, is like a pretty important first step to building solidarity and getting what you need in the newsroom. I'm very pro labor rights. And so, yeah, I think that if people aren't listening, then you build a coalition, you get them to listen by forming a union. That would be my first step of advice.
I love that. I would say, part of my job is actually to deal with a lot of people who do not believe in what we do, generally. And specifically with mental health, one of the things I use to convince people is that if they don't care or understand psychological well-being and mental health, they understand productivity. So I bring it in a way that is like, okay, if you have these journalists that have been covering all of these things in a row without a break or without providing them with the resources that they need, they will be burnt out. Your productivity will stop. Or also like the financial aspect of it, turnover is expensive. It's very expensive. So you can actually do simple things to support your staff to understand trauma or bring organize. So it's better, it's easier for newsrooms, at least in my experience, to bring someone outside to listen to than to listen to the staff. So if you bring in like trainings about safety or about diversity or anything like that, and you make sure to highlight the point of mental health, it could work better or could work more. That's not a good thing to have, but this is what I'm seeing from my experience. But I'm relating it a lot to productivity and to the financial aspect of it. And this is when people listen more, yeah. At least in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I would just add, you know, similar to the unionizing conversation, like fortifying your networks is so critical. Like when I think of the work that I do at Project Drawdown, where I've been for 3.5 years, there was a position listing for a manager of storytelling at the time, and nothing about that was about identity or bringing in underrepresented voices. And that's what I told them as I was interviewing, is that I wanted to center that work. And of course, that comes with its own risks and challenges, you know, internally, externally. And something that I always say to myself is that because of the networks that I've formed in my career, the communities that I've built, like, as long as I'm doing the right thing and as long as I'm advocating for, whether that's, like, for the representation of the communities that I'm fighting for or for, like, rest in this work, that if something negative happens, if a boss decides that they don't like that, well, I have this entire community that's there that has my back, and you know, they're going to learn that they can't continue to deprioritize those things. They need to realize that, like, this is the way that we need to be. Rest is important. Care is important. Community is important. And then all of, like, the economic arguments. As a business major, I'm like, yeah, of course. Like, the money is there. So, like, there are all these reasons why it's so critical to prioritize everything you're talking about. But they just need to learn and get on board and get up to date, because like, all of us are on board. We get it. Like, we're here for a reason. We know this is important.
I just have one quick final point. I always equate mental health to physical health. Mm. My mother, I love her dearly, but always asks, well, why do you need therapy if you, like, or if you're feeling okay? And I'm like, well, you would never tell me to not go get a checkup or not go to the doctor if I was physically feeling unwell, or even just I wanted to make sure everything was, you know, running well. So why is my mental health deprioritized? It's the same thing. My physical health affects my mental health. My mental health affects my physical health. So if you are telling me that I need to take care of myself physically in a workplace, that is the same as taking care of myself mentally in a workplace.
Hi, everyone. My name is Elijah DeCastro. I'm a Report for America Corps member. I work at a small weekly in rural South Carolina, and I cover Allendale County, which is the most rural county in the state. It's about 80 to 85% black, and that community has really been dealt a really rough hand over the years, and stuff like climate change and environmental issues are, they're not really within the community's consciousness because there's so many more issues that are just really urgent and pressing, like gun violence, health-related issues, education, that kind of stuff. And I've really wanted to get into helping that community understand the climate crisis and environmental issues and that kind of thing. And they're certainly affecting the community, but I was just curious to hear your thoughts on how to introduce an issue as urgent as the climate crisis to a community that is already facing urgent issues, and you know, how to do it in a way where it doesn't, you know, add one, you know, another terrible thing that they have to think about into the community's kind of information ecosystem.
Yeah, I think a really powerful question, and my gut reaction is, number one, to challenge that assumption that climate change isn't in their consciousness. Like, so often when it comes to black and brown communities, the assumption is that we don't care about climate. We don't know about climate. Even with the people that I interview, what I think is so fascinating is that when I ask them what motivates them to do the work that they do, very rarely is climate what they mention. It's family, it's health, it's jobs, it's safety, it's security, it's joy, all these other things. And so I would say that really giving the community the space to define what climate change or what their relationship with nature is, whether or not you use the phrase climate change in your day-to-day work or think about it day-to-day, two things, there are at least two things that are true. There are a lot of things that are true, but two things that are true. One of them is that you can still contribute to climate solutions. You can still have jobs and roles where you're doing the right thing to move our communities forward. But the other thing is that, like, whether or not day-to-day you're recognizing it, like, you can still have the healthy habits for yourselves that move these things forward. And so, I mean, like, I think that's kind of, maybe to, like, phrase this as questions for you to think about and for anyone to think about who has that perspective on their community. How are you getting that community feedback? What forms those perceptions that they don't care about or know about climate? How are they talking or thinking about climate in ways that you're not, or in ways that you're not talking about it? What's their connection with nature? I think of one of my interviewees, who John Shell Johnson, who lives in New Orleans, who works at a farm called Grow Dat Youth Farm. And she's talking to me not only about the ways how she uses farming for self-sufficiency and to build that, but, like, the legacies of slavery. Like, we've been on this land connected with nature and our climate for so long, including in places like South Carolina, including in places like Georgia in the South. So, I mean, I think, to me, I would say to update the criteria we have, or the criteria that you have that qualifies someone to know about climate or speak about climate, because, like, we've been here doing it. You know, we know what's up, as one of my interviewees has said. So, yeah, there's a lot more to that. But that's just it.
I think one more thing to add to that is I agree with every single thing you said. Yeah. And also, I think we're trying to define what does it mean to care about the environment and force it on the community instead of framing what does that mean based on the community. And this is the problem that we keep facing in a lot of issues, is that let's just listen to what does it mean for them, for the community themselves. And then we update our definitions, not the opposite. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't update my definition and then go to the community and force it on them. But, like, what does it mean for them? And then I update my definitions on that. And the other thing is, there are so many things that are related to the environment without really the word climate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like food scarcity, like access to healthy food, clean water, access to a lot of things, energy, all of these things, housing, heat waves, all of the things that are related to the environment without really necessarily the word climate in it. So finding that and asking questions about that, you can have a story about the climate, but it's built on the community's definitions.
I have, like, one other sentence to add, just bouncing back and forth. But one other thing to add for us all to think about and just recognize that so often when it comes to, there's a few things to slide in here, which is one, that we know that the communities, sure, we know the communities is most vulnerable to the impacts of the climate crisis and also least represented in so many climate spaces. Shout out to Green 2.0, which I know covers a lot when it comes to, pay equity and representation in these spaces, like that Black and brown communities, Black communities, Indigenous communities, communities of color are often not represented. But something that's really harmful that I think we need to be careful about is the victimhood narratives that we have around communities. People aren't victims. More often than not, I think underrepresented communities are incredible, like, hotspots of resilience, incredible survivors. But also, we have the potential, and not only the potential, but we have this history of being heroes pushing back against the inequities that are there. And so I would just say to challenge the idea that people need to be, like, helped and supported, and said, what power do they have that we could then learn to integrate and better value and amplify?
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Celeste Gracia. I am a reporter at the local NPR station in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I have a more soft and fluffy question for y'all. I am not afraid to admit that I cry a lot, and I have cried several times because of the work that we do. I will be interviewing someone, or I'll be in a meeting, and it just kind of hits me. We were talking about how climate is very emotional. And it'll hit me, like, that we're cutting down trees or polluting our water, et cetera. And so I just start crying. So my question is, have y'all cried because of this? And I ask because I'm just kind of looking for solidarity, and I just want to make sure that I'm not alone.
I cry all the time.
Same.
All the time. I if I am too far on any emotional scale, mm-hmm. I am crying. Sophia can attest that I cry all the time at work.
Sometimes we cry at the same time.
So we are right there with you. And it's I have definitely cried because I am like in the Slack reading messages from our members who are really, really struggling. But then I have also cried because I've read this like the most beautiful solutions-based story. And I'm like, there is hope. We are like not entirely screwed yet. But just all that to say, I also am with you. I cry all the time. And it's, I think crying sometimes is the most cathartic and healthy thing you can do for yourself.
100%. One quick addition. I wish I cry more. I do not know how to do it. So I watch sad movies to do it. But because I know that like I need to cry, but I really don't know how exactly to do it. But one thing I would say is that, again, being aware of our own like triggers, being aware of our own, like everything that is affecting us is very healthy. And crying is very natural for the body to release stress or even happiness at this point. Like anything that is like, you know, intense, that's very normal and that's totally fine. Because I just want to understand your question properly. If your worry or concern is crying while doing an interview or in other times?
No, I'm not worried about how much I cry. My therapist says it's healthy. Yeah,
exactly. It is healthy.
I just want to make sure that, like, I'm the only environmental reporter in my newsroom, and sometimes my coworkers will ask me how I'm doing, and I don't know how to answer the question, and I feel like everyone in this room as environmental reporters, y'all get it.
Yeah.
More than
no, you're not. At all.
Oh, I'm going to go here, and then back there, and then here.
All right. Well, I guess maybe my question is a good follow-up to this. I'm Jill Hopke, and I'm on the journalism faculty at DePaul University in Chicago. And I'm wondering, you know, how can those of us teaching journalism better support student journalists? Because students in my classrooms will often say, is there any hope? Or, you know, just, again, challenging the doom and gloom narratives, you know, in terms of teaching future journalists to have or develop skills and communities to cope more with the challenges that come with this beat.
Thanks, Jill. I was teaching last semester at CUNY Newmark. It was my first time teaching J school students, and I was really blown away by how little conversations they've had within J school on this topic. I think it's sorely needed in J school. Like, I wish when I was in J school, we had talked about the emotional weight of storytelling and figured out how to cope and how to navigate those, because you are thrown into the field and you're just sort of figuring it out on your own, especially as like a, you know, a young graduate. I do think that it's upon us, it's really our responsibility as educators to teach those tools to our students. I had a lesson last year in the class where I brought in Rebecca Weston of the Climate Psychology Alliance of North America, and she really helped break down for the students sort of like what happens internally with our psyche when we're confronted with interviews and sources, and how we can try to actually bring that into our craft and be more mindful and sensitive and loving in our reporting to take care of both of ourselves, but also of the communities we're reporting on. And like, I think 99% of my students said that that was their favorite lesson of the semester because of just how necessary it was. And these were like, this was their last semester, they're about to graduate. This is a graduate school program. And they had expressed that they had never been explained this sort of like physiological, psychological responses that I think as humans we should know so that we can better understand ourselves. And so it's disappointing to me, to be frank, that there's not more conversations about this in J school. But I do think that we're entering an era now where educational institutions and educators ourselves are putting more effort and resources into this. And there's now more journalism institutions that are creating resources for us, like the Dart Center. And yeah, I think our students need a lot more support than what we're giving them on this topic.
I'll also say, so I'm on the advisory council for an organization called Planet Forward, which works with student journalists or students who to expose them to environmental journalism and storytelling. And one of the things I find so fascinating is that I've been brought in a number of times, not only to connect with their students, but to the students with the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, where Planet Forward's based. And this is a conversation that comes up. And not to get into the conversation on objectivity, but I feel like there is this like parallel conversation that they're having, or this thought that they're having about, like, I'm supposed to be unbiased. Like, I'm supposed to be objective. I can't bring in my emotions and how I show up. But I think we might have mentioned this earlier, referenced this earlier, like the leadership or the ways that we model certain behaviors is really important. So I'll talk about, like, in the work that I do, connecting with any communities, I always go in sharing my story and why I do the work I do, because why we choose to show up in the ways we do matter. And I'll talk about how, like, my dad 7 years ago passed away, and how I experienced grief and navigated that. I'll talk about the how that ties to my value of storytelling. And it's this incredible, vulnerable thing. And people, you know, thank me for sharing something that's like that was such a huge loss in my life, because like that gives them permission to show up fully. So just as we think about how we have conversations and create space for that dialogue around emotions, around this very real aspect of telling stories or hearing stories, whatever you want to call it, I mean, it's also important that we model for them that it's okay to be vulnerable. And being a leader in the room or being at the front of the classroom is a great opportunity to show up fully in your story. I work with so many and speak with so many educators, actually, in the work that I do at Project Drawdown through our Drawdown's Neighborhood series. And like the thing I love about that is that they not only take back tools for their communities and for their students, but they also like show up fully. They bring their climate stories, the ups, the downs, the vulnerability, the successes, the superpowers. I love to also bring in that superpower piece, because we're not all just, you know, broken and traumatized as much as we are by this system. You know, there's like, we have a lot of strengths that we're bringing to fight this thing. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is like showing up as yourself, showing up as human. It's the theme. That's the theme for today. I love it.
I think we have time for a couple more questions.
My name is Erastus Asaridonko. I work with the multimedia group in Ghana, West Africa. I wanted to bring just a diverse perspective to the community conversation. Where I am, many communities are plagued by irresponsible mining for gold. Mm-hmm. And a lot of communities have been affected. In my newsroom, I have like 5 complaints every day. People gather themselves and they come to the community that they want us to come to their aid. To do what? To look at the devastation, to report on it, get the attention of authorities to help them. Because you have illegal miners invading their farms, destroying their water bodies, destroying the environment, and they can no longer farm with the polluted water and all that. To me, that's what gets me crying. I go to the communities, I look at how livelihoods have been affected, people who are helpless, and how mining is affecting them in a way. It gets you emotional sometimes. But I have been reporting on it extensively. It wasn't getting the solutions I required. So recently, I decided that I'll get some funding, go to the communities themselves, show my documentaries, which of course is enlightening to them, to tell them that the polluted waters you see there are very dangerous. You don't have to swim in it. You don't have to drink it. You cannot use it for farming and other things. And they need to empower themselves to stop what is going on at the local level. And so far we've been doing community tours. It's been helping. Many of them are getting enlightened. Now they are fighting for themselves. They have a say in who mines on which land and close to water bodies and all that. Thank you.
Sorry, I just had such a strong reaction, and I found myself oddly getting like emotional as you were sharing that. You know, as I mentioned with the Drawdowns Neighborhood series, like one of the biggest things that I do is talks and workshops and screenings and sharing the stories with communities. And the reason that so many of the current stories we share, which are focused on victimhood, you know, why they frustrate me is because those stories really form how we see ourselves. They function as a mirror so often. And so when we show people stories of like what they can do, because yeah, there are systemic issues. We need policy change in so many ways. We need corporations and really powerful actors to change. But that doesn't mean that we don't have incredible power on the individual level, on the community level, from a grassroots perspective, right? And so, I just love shout out to you for what you're doing, for sharing those stories, because it's been said so often, like you can't be what you can't see, mm-hmm. and we all, as storytellers, have the power to help people see at least, you know, another version of what they can be and what they're capable of, the powers that they have to bring to the table.
Thank you so much. I think we have time for one final question.
Yeah. Hello, I'm Sabrina Iglesias. Hi, Sabrina. I'm a community engagement editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm sure a lot of us can relate to this. When I get like super locked into what I'm doing, I'm like, I am like eyes on the prize. I'm focused. And I'm wondering how you all check in with yourselves and what you do right when you realize like, oh, I think I've gone too far with how locked in I am.
We'll have rapid fire answers because we're running out of time.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding. You're saying like when you're really locked into like the work, like you're just like in the zone. Yeah, I think that I'm lucky in that I live with my partner. So sometimes he'll be like, hey, are you going to wrap up soon? And so I have sort of like a personal outside entity that can come and check in on me. And so I think for folks who don't have that, right, maybe setting a timer, like setting yourself a little alarm. Again, I mentioned this earlier. I think it's just like boundaries are really important. If you need to log off at 6 because that's what you require, you have to do that, right? Which is hard because I can be in the zone, and sometimes I get in the zone at like 5:30 and I'm like, oh no, like the writing is coming out so beautiful right now and I have to keep going. I have to ride this wave. But I have to stop. I like 6:30 is like, I'm like, oh no, it's going too far. I'm going to end up working all night if I don't stop. And so sort of reminding yourself, like, I go to therapy and my therapist is helping me develop mantras because I have debilitating anxiety sometimes. And she's like, one of the mantras we've put together, especially because I get really stressed out about work and having to complete all my tasks, is that there is always more time and I will get it done because I always do. And so that works for me because I do always get my work done. And so figuring out what the mantras are for you that can sort of ground you when you're starting to feel overwhelmed, and a reminder that like, there is always tomorrow, right? You can get in the zone again tomorrow. And how can you curate that vibe, right? To like get in the zone, what helps you get there so you can try to optimize it? I hate that word, but like how can you make sure that you get in the zone when you need to rather than like at the most inconvenient time? It's definitely like an art and not a science. But yeah, I think figuring out how to like set those reminders that can like snap you out of it is really key.
Put it on your calendar. Honestly, like everything I do, like gym time, actually like sleeping, I put things on my calendar that don't make sense because it sounds like it's a common sense something that you should do, but I will forget to do them. Like I will forget to eat, I will forget to take a break, I will forget to do all of these things. So I put it on my calendar. The other thing is one of the things that works for me is that how I can hold myself accountable to rests or to breaks is that I schedule things, for example, with friends. So tomorrow or the day after at 5, 6, 7, whatever time it is, I am doing this thing. It can be someone coming over to my house and watching a movie and actually not talking at all. But I need to hold myself accountable. And for me, because it's hard for me to prioritize my own care or like my own rest, I try to do it with friends and we hold each other accountable for that. And if it's on my calendar, most probably it will happen. So...
thank you all so much for those wonderful answers. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Clearly, this is a conversation we could talk about all day. I'm just going to say, like, at the end of this conversation, what's sticking with me is that care and community and bringing our full, authentic, emotional selves isn't just a climate solution. It's a powerful, radical act with the... with a potential to transform this industry. And I want to say a huge thank you to our wonderful panelists for bringing their whole selves and sharing them with us today. Thank you all. Some of the resources that they shared today will, in the next few months, be on the Uproot Project website. So if you guys will check that out, and feel free to come and talk to the panelists. Thank you all.